snowmobiles. If you have a snowmobile, we want it.
We also want any extra cars, trucks, SUVs, RVs, boats, and more. Any reason is a good reason to give a vehicle to WBAI. Some do it to avoid the hassles of selling. Some like to skip the costs of repairing, while others just enjoy the good feelings of giving back to their community. But no matter your reason, donating a vehicle to WBAI is a great idea. And it's easy. Here's how it works. Simply call 866-WBAI-CAR. That's 866-922-4227. Or give online at WBAI.org/donate-your-car. Our vehicle donor support team will arrange your free pickup. When the driver arrives to tow away your great gift, you'll receive a donation receipt. Vehicle donations have the potential to drive hundreds and sometimes even thousands of dollars to WBAI. Call 866-WBAI-CAR or visit WBAI.org/donate-your-car.
And you're tuned to WBAI New York, WBAI.org online. Sojourner Truth, hosted by Margaret Prescott, is the, or was, just the concluded show. Coming up next, the Independent News Hour with John Talton and Amber Gagarin. Stay tuned.
Good evening and welcome to the Independent News Hour. I'm John Tarleton, Editor-in-Chief of The Independent, New York City's lefty newspaper and website. We're also online at independent.org, independent.org. We've got another amazing show for you, and I'm joined today by The Independent's Associate Editor, Amber Gagarin.
Hi, John. It's great to be here with you and all of our listeners on 99.5 FM and streaming on WBAI.org.
Well, we have some exciting news to share. Earlier today, we began distributing our beautiful, brand-new May print edition of The Independent newspaper. You can find it in our red and white news boxes across the city and in more than 60 public libraries and other venues.
In this issue, we look at the largest outpouring of student protest on college campuses since the Vietnam War era and the violent state repression pro-Palestinian protesters have endured.
We also hear directly from city workers about the impact of the mayor's budget cuts and how they have degraded public services across the city. Indy's Ted Hamm has a deep dive piece on the immunity enjoyed by prosecutors who win false convictions and send innocent people to prison for decades. And we hear from a veteran union organizer about last month's Labor Notes conference in Chicago.
And, John, you had a cover story that reflects on the campus movement for free Palestine and for an end to the war in Gaza and obviously a divestment from Israel from their universities. So talk about kind of what that was like, reflecting on that whole...
Yeah, this whole moment.
This whole moment, you know, having also lived through many others.
Right. So the piece is called The Perfect Storm, How a Livestream Genocide, Clueless College Administrators, and Heavy-Handed Policing Ignited America's College Campuses. This piece really just attempts to synthesize a lot of what has transpired over the last 4 weeks or so. And something I was struck by when you sort of juxtapose the moral passion and clarity of the students and their supporters and how you really have this sort of, these neoliberal university presidents and top administrators who immediately went for the police. And our whole policing culture is so heavy-handed and so over the top in this country. I guess it didn't occur to them that the students might not be cowed by their awesome show of force, but instead be outraged and draw inspiration from one encampment to the next. It all started as one encampment at Columbia. They got heavy-handed almost immediately, and it spread like wildfires. So yeah, it's a meditation on reflection on all of that and sort of where we are as a culture and something, you know, as you said, I've seen a lot of left-wing movements and moments over the last 30-plus years, and I was struck by how the 9/11 moment in our culture where we really ramped up the whole security state still lives on with us, and we're still poisoned by it, and we see that kind of repressive logic used against Occupy, it was used against Black Lives Matter, even being deployed on these college campuses, which are supposed to be a bastion of rational thought and discussion, and these university leaders immediately, in many cases, went straight to the police to spare themselves having to debate in with their students tough questions about their university's relationship to Israel, whether that's in the form of investments or exchange programs or anything else. So we're in quite a moment, and I so applaud the students all across the country that have done what they did and are continuing to do.
Right, a few of who we're going to hear from in a moment here.
Yeah, we got two of them here in the studio with
us.
They're
going to
join
us
in a few minutes. So very excited to hear from them. And you had a really stellar article about an immigrant named Marcial Morales, who you covered three, four years ago when he was leading hunger strikes from inside an ICE detention center. Incredibly courageous, a man who managed to get himself and others released on humanitarian parole, and you followed up to find out what life is like kind of after that peak moment of activism and how he's living his life.
Well, I'm sure Marcial would like to say those, men also did it themselves, everyone having struck. Marcial struck 9 days. He has diabetes, so his health deteriorated really quickly, but we spoke with others who struck like in the 30s and up to 42 days.
And you covered that back then.
Yeah, so now a couple and a half years later, things aren't going that well because they are all still under ICE supervision and facing imminent deportation. So I write about that and about how they deal with it and cope with it and continue to be resilient, but also it's really damning for your mental health. So I think I, talk about the reality of that. But I also have another piece that I'm excited to talk about and brings us into our first segment. I don't know if I could say excited to talk about, but I did this piece. We did this piece, Fly a Kite for Refaat Al-Ariad. And Refaat was, a Palestinian from Gaza who was a very beloved educator, writer, poet, and was killed by Israel on January 20th. So I hope people pick up the paper and have a chance to read from him himself. Most of this piece is we repent if I must die, but a lot of people haven't read much else from Al-Ariad. That was important to have in there.
No, it's beautiful.
And I want to go now to our first segment, because we are gonna hear from Sunil, who was an organizer at the Refaat Al-Ariad Gaza Solidarity Encampment, which is the first and only faculty encampment in the United States and the only standing Gaza Solidarity Encampment here in New York City. I spoke with Sunil just a little bit earlier today, and they caught me up on what's going on there. This is at the new school. Did I not say that? I'm so sorry. This is at the new school. And then in a bit, we're going to hear from students that were with the Gaza Solidarity Encampment at the new school, the student encampment that was raided and shut down over a week ago. But now let's go to this clip from Sunil.
So, Sunil, thanks so much for being here with The Independent. Let's jump right into it. So tell me about the decision for faculty Gaza Solidarity Encampment to be erected at the new school. How did that go, and was that difficult?
Yeah, so two Fridays ago, our over 40 students were arrested and raided by the riot police, called on by the administration while they were sleeping in the early morning, after an intense night of negotiations. So the administration took the opportunity to violently, you know, essentially raid the encampment. We were with our students at jail support, and we recognized as faculty that this was just so beyond reproach that we were outraged, we were angry, we knew we had to do something because our students' voices were being silenced. And so we were looking for the opportunity to start the encampment as a way to show that they cannot silence these voices, whether it's students or faculty or staff or whoever, that our voices are stronger together, and we needed to move beyond just reacting to actually acting, acting as a taking autonomous action, essentially, which led to the building of the encampment, the first faculty encampment in the country and the only remaining encampment in New York. It has been, an incredible opportunity to really learn from the students and understand how, as a community, we can fight together for divesting from these war profiteers, from U.S. Mm-hmm. imperialism, from mm-hmm. All of the, to get our cops off campus, to get the cops off campus, and for all of our other demands, including amnesty for students, faculty, and staff.
Right, beautiful. Like you said, the new school faculty got the solidarity encampment is the only one standing in New York right now. And so when you say, like, we decided to do this, who is we? Is it a certain group
of
faculty?
So there was, yeah.
Is it just autonomous?
Sorry, yeah, I interrupted you.
It's okay.
So there's a Faculty for Justice in Palestine working group that right. sort of came out of the Students for Justice in Palestine. We wanted a way to support the students, but also to be able to pressure from within the university and pressure the administration, through the relationships that faculty have and the pressure points that we can identify. And so through that, through the kind of team of FJP, there was a group of us that took autonomous action that realized that we needed to be done, something drastic, something that really sort of helped to resurrect the spirit of the student encampment. And something that could live beyond us potentially and become mm-hmm. a much more than just a faculty encampment, to become a community encampment, right? So we recognize that this would be in the morning of the establishment of the encampment, we recognize that because FIT had just been raided the night before, we would be the only standing encampment and the first faculty encampment in the country. And so we recognize the sort of symbolic power of this space for the wider community. And, it's really like whether it's students or faculty, it doesn't matter. This is all one movement. This is a movement to end the genocide. This is a movement for Palestinian liberation. And this is a movement to get war profiteers, not just off of our campus, but to end sort of capitalist machine of war profiteering.
Absolutely. And so tell me a little bit about, like, what, you know, you said it's only so far only first faculty encampment. You've been going now for nearly a week. You started on Wednesday, last Wednesday, May 8th. What's it been like at the encampment? How many people have been filtering in and out?
Yeah, it kind of goes, various numbers each night. You know, like our first night we had maybe like 10 people, and then the next night it doubled. And then, you know, so we had like people kind of coming in and out pretty consistently. I think we recognize how some of our colleagues and faculty have various responsibilities, children, their caregivers, et cetera, and some mm-hmm. of them are, older than some of us who are maybe able to actually spend the night, on these very kind of, I don't want to say it's brutal conditions, but I will say that because
it's uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable. I mean, it's a Ritz hotel compared to like, to some of the other encampments even that have had to stay outside in the cold. We are an inside encampment, and so yes. but the thing that is really terrible for us is that we have these fluorescent lights that do not turn off, and that the security refuses to turn off. And so we are sort of bombarded by the hellish, you know, fluorescent tubes that really just penetrate right through your eye mask. So it's a bit, you know, each encampment poses its own unique challenges. I've been fortunate enough to visit Columbia and spend some time at Columbia and some of these other encampments. And so, it's interesting to see the differences. There are, you know, ups and downs to every encampment, of course. You know, there's tensions are high, people are exhausted, but we all know that we're here for one fight, and that's the fight for Palestinian liberation.
Great. Okay, and so, you know, one sort of quick question here.
Yeah.
As far as you can discern, how many people are with you? I mean, among the faculty, how is the faculty split at large? How has the faculty at large been responding?
Yeah, so I mean,
and how has the administration been responding?
Sure. So the faculty is overwhelmingly supportive of us, especially, you know, even if they can't directly support it. I think that they are also pushing for divestment. Every school, you know, at this college, every kind of like major school, right? You have Parsons, you have Eugene Lang, you have all these NSSR. So you have all these different kind of like schools at the college, and each one has passed overwhelmingly a divestment resolution, as well as there was a large no confidence vote in the administration. So people, like, even if they're not at the encampment, we know that there are faculty working on multiple fronts to push for divestment, right? And so we know that there are a lot of people who are in solidarity with us. We do ask that faculty step up. We ask that faculty across the country step up and escalate and continue to show up and continue to fight harder and harder and to risk more and more. What I don't see is enough tenure track faculty or just tenured faculty really risking you know, what they can. I mean, the thing is that a lot of us are the most vulnerable people in this in encampment, meaning like part-time faculty, where we don't have contracts, you know, we don't have some of us are not annualized. And so we're like semester by semester. But the tenure track faculty that have job security, those are the ones who can be doing a lot more. And that's what I want to see. And that's what I call upon, is the faculty that are safe. They need to be bold. They need to be bold in their actions. They need to be bold with their voices. And they need to come out here and show up, because the ones who are risking the most right now are the ones who are already the most vulnerable with our careers.
Great. Absolutely. So, you know, in that mindset, you have your demands, what are the goals for moving forward here? Obviously the semester is ending. You know, what's the plan?
So the plan is to keep fighting for divestment for as long as we can. We are going to continue to escalate, to continue to show the administration that if they do not continue to negotiate with us and do not heed our demands, that we will continue showing up and we will continue fighting in whatever way we can. The encampment's not going anywhere. We are still pushing as hard as we can on multiple fronts. And we are going to make our voices heard, and they are going to regret the day that they did not take us seriously.
Last question, you know, here, just zooming out slightly, you, Sunil, took part in the part-time faculty strike 2 years ago. That was the longest adjunct strike ever at the new school, in the history of adjunct strikes, and that was at the new school. And now we have the non-academic student workers, you know, authorizing the strike vote just in the past few days. They've also been outside of the student Gaza Solidarity encampments at the new school, and there's been a strong connection between labor and this action for a free Palestine. But can you kind of explain that better?
You know, that's actually like the one thing I'm like not particularly like super up on. But I will say that in our demands that we support the New Student Workers Union and their fight to be recognized as a protected union. And that we call upon the university to recognize them as in their demands as well. And so a lot of there's a lot of fluidity between the New Student Workers Union as well as the Gaza the Rafat al-Arir faculty solidarity encampment, as well as the Faculty for Justice in Palestine, as well as Students for Justice in Palestine. So there's a bit of fluidity.
We very much know that our demands are intertwined, and that the role that labor plays in ending the genocide is essential. We know that there's a deep commitment between labor and anti-imperialism, and so we understand that you know the that Palestine is a labor issue, and that when we organize as workers, we strengthen our movement around the world. And that the workers in Gaza, the workers in Palestine, and the workers here at the university that are fighting to end the genocide, that we are, you know, we fight with each other, and we know we learn from each other. We learn from each other's tactics. You know, the fact that like the strikes from workers in Palestine in the early 30s were some of the most effective forms of anti-colonial a labor stoppage. You know, we have to look to our history, and we have to understand the role that labor plays in fighting against imperialism and capitalism worldwide.
Absolutely. Okay, Sunil.
Thank
with,
you.
The group of Faculty for Justice in Palestine taking autonomous action to start the Gaza Solidarity encampment in the name of Rafat Al-Arir. Thank you so much for joining us on the Independent News Hour.
All right. That was an interview that I did earlier today with Sue Neal, an organizer at the Rafat Al-Arir Gaza Solidarity encampment at the New School. And we are joined now by Jenna and Rose with the New School Student Gaza Solidarity encampment, also with the New School branch of Students for Justice in Palestine. You know, they were organizers of the Gaza Solidarity encampment, which lasted over a week and was shut down when the universities called the police on May 3rd, so that was two Fridays ago. Jenna is an undergraduate student studying global studies, and Rose is pursuing a master's in international affairs. Welcome both of you to the Independent News Hour here on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
It's great to be here with you. So we're going to jump straight into it. I think first we would just, you know, like to sort of commemorate the Nakba. Tomorrow is a Nakba day, and Nakba in Arabic means catastrophe. And it's marked on May 15th because that's when Zionists seize control of Palestine. And over the course of May 15th, 1948 is when they technically seized control of Palestine. But between 1947 and 48, they killed, you know, at least 10,000 Palestinians, displacing and depopulating 750,000, sort of evicting 400 villages, burning villages in an act of ethnic cleansing that made Israel's founding possible. Israel has its, Day of Independence is what they call it. Today, started last night. So, you know, we're, like I said, we're really happy to be here with Jenna and Rose. And Rose is with us. Rose is Palestinian. So I just wanted to, you know, let you know that we stand with your people and with the Free Palestine, and ask you to talk about Nakba, like what that means for you and anything you'd like to share about, you know, that being tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you. So, as you said, Nakba Day is tomorrow, May 15th, and it commemorates 76 years since the initial uprooting and ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people. And with that, I will say that the original population that was killed or expelled made up about a third of the Palestinian population. And as a sign of our resilience and our dedication as a people to come back home, because there is a strong belief in the Palestinian movement that refugees will return, the Palestinian population, despite the ethnic cleansing that we face, has increased in multitudes of numbers since then. There's about 4 million Palestinians that live within Palestine and in occupied land, which is Israel, and about 10 million that live outside of that. So there's obviously the struggle, and also where resistance through our existence is still very prominent and still very relevant today, as we see. I also wanted to say that everything that has been ongoing, not just within the last year, but in also the last 76 years, is relevant to tomorrow, because it shows that the Nakba never stopped. It's still ongoing, and we're still living through it today.
Right. Well, thank you for sharing. And so you've been here. Your family has been in the States for a while, or when did they?
Yeah, so I myself was born in Palestine, but I moved to the States relatively young. Like many families that live in diaspora, we've kind of experienced both lives of living in America for a few years, living in Palestine for a few years. But my family just recently moved back this summer.
Okay. Well, now you're here with us in New York and organizing, you know, at your university. So let's get into the talk about the encampment that I said was violently taken down by the police two Fridays ago, May 3rd, but stood for 11 days. So that was longer than most of the encampments in the city and in the country and beyond. Why do you think that it was able to last for so long, the encampment? And then over that time, you know, was there any progress made with administration at any point?
We believe that the encampment was able to last for so long because our school was initially, like many institutions, founded on the principles of social justice. And I believe that our school wanted to give us the ability to exercise our rights as they should, of course, our right to free speech, our right to protest. I'm sure that there was multiple conversations among administration as to how to go about it. But also, as students, we did our best to comply with the policies, granted that it was an escalation to try to meet our demands. But also, the general vibe of our encampment was that it was peaceful, it was a place of learning, it was a place of community. And so for that reason, I believe that most administrators, faculty, students didn't have any issue with it being set up. Ultimately, we felt that the encampment came to such a brutal end in the way that it did, mainly because of our current interim president, Donna Shalala. But outside of that, there really wasn't any conversations about getting it swept in the way that it was.
Right. And can you just to allow, you talk about how there is a peaceful vibe and sharing and learning. Can you just give a little bit more sense of the sort of daily activities that went on? Like when you say there was sharing and learning, like mm-hmm. how was that carried forth?
Yeah, we had a great programming committee just fostering many teach-ins and music and any type of like form of resistance that we could garner. We had just like daily programmings, teach-ins with thinkers and revolutionists. We encouraged professors to come and host their classes there. So you know, and we had so much like support also from like the external public. We got so much hot meals and supplies, and we felt very taken care of, and we felt really spoiled as well. But you know, in terms of community, it was very loved because we knew why we were there. We were there for Gaza, and in that way, what we were doing was the merest efforts, really, in terms of escalating or whatnot. That was also a great form of community. Doing it together, again, our participants increased by the day, so it was only growing. And I guess what Rose was saying too, I mean, we know that the school is going to use our encampment in the future, put on a brochure, try to lure more students in and claim that they were on the right side of history. You know, 45 students got arrested and suspended for what, abiding by the school's moral values. So again, I mean, like what Rose said, we had a lot of support from the student body, and that's what garnered a lot of the community.
And it was also the difference in the fact that New School's infrastructure is set up different from other schools. So we weren't outside. We don't have like a courtyard or a campus. So majority of everything that took place was inside, which I think made a really big difference in terms of the kind of oppression that we faced. It was always this fear of them not wanting to bring in police on campus because it would have affected a lot of the community. But then we can go into talking about how that went down.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. Yeah, we will do that here in a second. And, you know, I spent, I was there a few days and I could attest to the fact that the vibe was committed, determined, peaceful, inquisitive about the others there. And it would like you had the right in the main lobby, you had the encampment off to the side after you enter. And then right outside, so on the street, you had like a constant kind of tabling of the non-academic student union, and then like a constant picket, which mm-hmm. was partially unionist, but partially just anybody that wanted to kind of come in. And, you know, a lot of the chants, some of the chants were labor-based, but most of them were like Free Gaza, Free Palestine. Mm-hmm. So that was great. But yeah, now let's get into the shutdown, because within a week, administrators at Columbia University, City College of New York, which was those both on the same day, Fordham University the following day, New York University and the New School both on the same day a couple days later, and then finally the Fashion Institute of Technology closing that, you know, week, which was 1 week ago, the FIT got shut down. So, campus administrators called on the NYPD at all those places, which showed up in riot gear in great force, with guns drawn at some at Columbia, SWAT type, military grade tanks, to be specifically correct, to disassemble these Gaza solidarity encampments. So tell us about what the police raid was like at the New School, where you actually had two encampments, one as we were just talking about in the entryway of the New School, but also one in the entryway of Parsons, which is a college at the New School.
Yeah, so I'll speak a little bit to that. It was definitely done in a way where, like you described, it was not as brutal as a removal as the different encampments, because it was done very, very early in the morning, where majority of the students were actually asleep in the encampment. And like we said, it was indoors. So the way that we were woken up was pretty alarming and pretty violent. Mm-hmm. Most of us had not gone to sleep until pretty late the night before. So it was done in a military style raid where, you know, people were coming in, wake up, it's the police are here. Those of us in the university center had a little bit of warning, at least of like 10, 15 minutes before it happened. But the Parsons School of Design, which is across the street, the students had absolutely no warning at all. Students were arrested and taken to jail in their pajamas. It was just really a sight to see. Also, it was the largest arrest in New School history. And like I mentioned before, it was done in a way where the president had kind of taken it upon herself to do so. We were confirmed the night before that if arrests or suspensions were imminent, that we would receive written warnings before, but we did not get that. The New School had also stated that students were given a chance to leave. That's not entirely true. Parsons students were not given a chance to leave. And so we were alarmed when we got to jail, and originally it was 15 of us that were arrested in the university center. And by the end, there was about 45 of us who were arrested. I'll just speak to it that this is something that really shocked and disturbed the entire New School community, as many faculty, administrators, and students weren't aware that this was coming. And also, we had received verbal confirmation many times from Interim President Shalala that she would not have been calling the police on us, because as in her time as an administrator, she's never done that to her students before, and she didn't plan on it. So we felt, although you have to take everything with a grain of salt from these types of administrators, more safe than other students in the encampments. And I will say that once we got into ourselves and our process, there were already students there, and they were from NYU. So NYU got swept an hour before we did.
Yeah.
So what are your plans now? If you want to talk about how you supported the faculty encampment and how you in general plan to keep the pressure up going forward.
Yeah, so as Alba mentioned, the faculty at the New School situated the Rafat al-Arid Solidarity Encampment just a couple days following our sweep and the raid. you know, it's very important to keep this momentum going. Escalation, again, is the merest of efforts that we could do to the people in Gazda. Like, this is a continuing struggle, and it shouldn't get watered down, I guess, also over the summer. Of course, you know, as you said, it may slow down, yeah, but
that could be a time to organize.
Absolutely. It's a time to strategize and see what goes next in, you know, next semester and the next following year. Again, our school is also, like, very different. We've had, like, I'm not sure how many strikes now, I can't keep up, but our last occupation, the part-time faculty occupation, we borrowed and used a lot of the repertoires used then. Again, the picket, I don't think anyone is doing a picket like ours.
And those students, the non-academic students, mm-hmm. are doing a strike authorization vote mm-hmm. yeah. right around sometime like today.
Yeah, and so, we're just... you know, reusing like historical tactics that we've used before, and placing them in at these encampments, and also the faculty they've just I guess took over or kind of
use the same infrastructure that we did at the student encampment mm-hmm. to kind of continue to elevate our demands mm-hmm. and show the university that this is a community-based effort that faculty and students plan on fighting this injustice mm-hmm. moving forward.
And they're also.
Yes, so we thank both of you, Jenna and Rose, for joining us today to share your story about the incredible work that you all did at those encampments at the new school.
We're going to get a really, really fast update from Jenna, and then we're going to wrap it.
Yes, so currently the faculty and other students are blocking the building across from the university center that had the initial encampment, just to further escalation and urge divestment.
So head over
currently
to the new school
at the moment
on
yes.
5th Ave and 13th Street.
63rd 5th Ave at the UC, right across.
5th Ave, yeah. If you can. Thank you so much for joining us, Jenna and Rose.
Thank you.
From SJP at the new school. We're going to do a quick music break here.
Sorry, I just want to have a nice guest.
أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم أناديكم أشد على أياديكم وأبوس الأرض تحت نعالكم وأقول أفديكم وأهديكم ضياع عيني ودفء القلب أعطي أهديكم ضياع عيني ودفء القلب أعطيكم فمأساتي التي أحيا نصيبي من مآسيكم وأهديكم ضياع عيني ودفء القلب أعطيكم فمأساتي التي أحيا نصيبي من مآسيكم أناديكم أشد على أنا ما هنت في وطني ولا صغرت أكتافي أنا ما
هنت أناديكم by Lebanese singer Ahmad Kabor. You're listening to the Independent News Hour on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm the Independent's editor, John Tarleton, here with Indy Associate Editor Amar Gagarian. Before we move on to our next segment, which we're really excited about, I want to encourage everybody who can do so to give to this radio station, call 212-209-2950 or go online to give number two, wbai.org. Your support for this show and for this station makes it possible for us to bring activists like Rose and Jenna on, who are at the forefront of the encampment movement that's really shaken this a political system and shaken the complacency around just shoveling more weapons to Israel over the past month. And we got to have them here live in the studio. That was great, Amba. And there's only one way we can keep that going.
Yeah, absolutely. frankly, by supporting the station, but really, do you want, if you want to be able to hear from people like that, people who are on the front lines of fights for justice, peace and justice, you know, then you have to kind of support the ability for us to be here on the station, to be using this equipment, to be paying the rent at the station, and also to be paying the rent at the antenna, you know, at Times Square.
That's $17,000 a month.
It frankly is that simple. It, when we don't get donations, we have to not have interviews like this. We literally get preempted. It's not fun for us. It's not fun for you to have to hear an hour of pitching. It's not fun for me to have to hear an hour of pitching. So literally, like do some harm reduction and donate to the show if you can. Donate to the radio, and the name of the show would be great, but donate to the station so that we can spend more time bringing on people who are on the ground fighting the fight for a better today, you know, and for justice and for peace. So please, you can call at 212-209-2950. Again, the phone number is 212-209-2950, or go online, give numeral 2WBAI.org. That's give numeral 2WBAI.org. This is a great gift for somebody. Let's say if you're a leftist and you're in a relationship with someone, you have a friend, you want to give them a gift. Donate to WBAI. I've literally done that myself. People appreciate. Keep the airwaves flowing. We are the only independent news source on the air in New York City. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. Or go to give numeral 2WBAI.org. And you can donate in the name of
the Independent News Hour.
Or become a WBAI buddy for $15 a month. Also in the name of the Independent News Hour. And really, $15 a month for some people is affordable. You know, if you're on a fixed income and you can only give once a year, we appreciate it. We love you. Today's the day to donate, not tomorrow.
That's right. And absolutely the best way you can support this station is to become a WBAI buddy, a monthly sustainer, whether it's $10, $15, $20, $25 a month or more, depending on what you're capable of. But it gives the station a certain amount of financial stability to have those monthly contributions coming in. And we know WBAI has been financially challenged for a while. And when you become a WBAI buddy, you make this station a little bit more solid. That's why we need you to call 212-209-2950 or go to give number 2WBAI.org. So we'll move on here. And speaking of building a culture of solidarity, which I think is the essence of what WBAI is all about, we turn in our next segment here to the Red Cosmos Society, which is dedicated to creating and spreading new holiday celebrations and rituals that embody leftist values, again, of solidarity and struggle to create a better world. On April 30th, I attended their May Day Eve celebration on the Lower East Side. It was a lefty version of a Passover Seder and much more, in which we shared food, song, affirmations. In this clip, you can hear participants belting out Solidarity Forever. Okay, so again, that was on April 30th, the May Day Eve celebration, sponsored by the Red Cosmos Society. Joining us now to talk about this is Alex Holmstrom Smith. She is the founder of the Red Cosmos Society. She was our MC for that celebration, and she's now coming on the Independent News Hour. Alex, welcome to WBAI Radio.
Hi, John. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, so Let's get going here. First of all, if you can just kind of set the scene for the April 30th event on May Day Eve. You were the master of ceremonies, and if you can kind of paint a picture for people of where we were and what you were overseeing.
Sure. So this is a holiday that I and some friends that we've now started a group, the Red Cosmos Society, have been celebrating for more than 5 years now, and it's kind of a modeled off of the Passover Seder, as you alluded to. So it's a big dinner, and we kind of have some readings and some songs and reflection time there. And I hosted it at my building. I happen to live in a building that was built by the Amalgamated Clothing and Textile Workers Union in 1929. It was originally affordable co-ops for workers. Unfortunately, it's now, you know, basically privatized, but it's still a cool space. And, you know, they had this big auditorium space that they originally built for workers to have cultural events together. So I think it's nice to have it there.
Right. And why do you feel like it's important to have these kind of alternative holidays?
Yeah. Well, I guess I grew up in a secular household, and my parents were actually Marxists and we were atheists. So we kind of celebrated Christmas, but not in a serious way, just for fun. But I thought it was really, you know, we did our political work, you know, going to meetings, demonstrations, whatever, but we didn't always have space to, you know, celebrate those values that we share in a more like serious and also joyful way. So that was kind of what I was thinking about when I started doing this. And, you know, May Day is the International Workers' Holiday, and it's always something where you go out and you're marching all day, but you don't necessarily get time to think like, what is the history of May Day, or why do we celebrate this? You know, what is it about and what does it mean? And so I think also holidays have some of that function of, because it's every year, you get, kind of prompts you to think about the time that has passed since the last one. And so I wanted to create some space for us to do that in a collective way together.
Right. That sounds awesome, Alex. You know, often May Day is celebrated, or International Workers' Day, in only very small spaces by a very small number of people here in the U.S. But talk about the Haymarket incident, you know, the impetus for International Workers' Day, and about how it was a struggle for time, and how time is value, is the material of our life.
Yeah. So the Haymarket incident was in 1886, and that was a big strike that took place in the Chicago area. And at the time, the workers' movement, which was, you know, really huge, they decided that the 8-hour day was going to be the main demand that united the workers' struggle. And so that was what that strike was about. And it ended up being repressed by police. And there were a bunch of people that were killed. And then 8 anarchists were basically framed for this bomb that was thrown at the time. And so they became like a cause célèbre that led to the holiday being celebrated around the world by working people. But I think it's interesting to think about it today that, you know, so many people still don't work an 8-hour day. And the slogan of that was 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will. And I think that what we will part is so crucial, because I read a little bit at the event from this philosopher, Martin Haglund, who's a Marxist philosopher, and he talks about how our human lives are finite. So, you know, the choice of what you do with your time, or what you're able to do with your time based on your socioeconomic situation, is really so important. It's really almost the most important thing on a kind of spiritual level of what we're even doing here, is how you spend your time, right? And so a lot of people have to spend so much of their time working for things that are really pointless. And so I think it's important to, you know, keep on like connecting that struggle today. I think sometimes people in workers' movements are thinking about getting more money. That's the workers' demand, but also having more of our free time is so essential. Mm-hmm. And then also I think that, you know, it might you know, thinking about that movement might also help us be a little bit reflective about how we spend our time, you know, in the discretionary time that we do have in our lives.
Right. And can you talk about some of the sort of affirmations that you sort of led over the course of this ceremony and why you picked the ones that you did?
Yeah. So, well, I kind of came up with these affirmations just to try to think of what are some of the values that unite us that we could just say them together, or sort of on theme with the holiday of May Day. So, for example, there's one that we say together, May Day is about the struggle for the 8-hour day and those who died for it. It is about the spring and our hopes, and it is also about our suffering. Let us remember them all. And so we say that together, and then we have some little foods that we eat to remember this struggle for the 8-hour day. And then we also talk about, like, there's one where we share break bread together, and we talk about how we believe that everyone should have bread, and that, you know, we're in solidarity with people who don't have bread. So those are some of the things that we say throughout the meal, kind of like, I guess, in a Seder, you say certain prayers at different points. That was kind of the idea of it.
Right. Well, you know, that's beautiful, but what do I say? But, and a lot of these demands, goals, ideas for a better future and a just society are, we have to admit, you know, all of us who are in the work, that maybe we could see it within our lifetime, maybe never, you know, who knows. So how does that keep you sort of like, how do you stay organized, you know, on the day to day when that's, you know, the probable reality?
Yeah. So that's a really important point, I think, because another thing that we realize, if you're, especially if you're someone who's been in organizing for a long time, you start to see how, like, these projects are bigger than our individual selves, and sometimes the work is not going to be completed in our lifetime. And I think that, you know, a lot of socialists, leftists, they love to do sort of academic analysis of, like, past movements and try to figure out, you know, what worked, what didn't work. And that's sort of their way of dealing with the legacy of the past and trying to bring those lessons into the future. But I wanted to do a kind of different engagement with the past, which is to talk about carrying on, like, the culture from the past, like the songs, and, you know, maybe starting these new rituals that we can use. And that, I think, when you are singing a song that someone sang 100 years ago, or you're doing a certain practice that people have done before, and you know other people are doing it still, or maybe people after you will continue this tradition, it's a way of sort of keeping the faith in what we believe in. And I think that's something that's really needed, especially when we're in times like these, when things often seem very, very dark.
Yes. And can you, we have just a couple more minutes here. First of all, can you describe the two other holidays that the Red Cosmos Society is promoting?
Yeah, so we do another one in the fall that's a little bit modeled after Dia de Muertos, where it's called Martyrs Day, and it's in like November, and we basically invite people to talk about anyone that they want to remember this year, anyone who's died, you know, that year or previous years, and it could be someone that they know personally, or, you know, maybe someone that inspires them politically. And we sing a lot of songs about martyrs from prior movements and try to think about, you know, the practice of remembering people. And we also do one in the summer called Cosmos Day, where we sort of do a little bit more of like a sci-fi theme, just thinking about, you know, humans' place in the cosmos and sort of how our, you know, anti-capitalist values can play into a kind of more humane vision for the future.
Nice. And last of all, can you let people know where they can find out more about the Red Cosmos Society?
Yeah, so we have a Facebook page, the Red Cosmos Society, and we have at Red Cosmos Society on Instagram. And so you can follow both of those and, you know, send us direct messages if you want to get on our email list. And we're trying to, you know, become more of a sustainable community in between these like big events that we hold. So we're going to start doing monthly, just small gatherings on the first Friday of every month in the evening. So if people get on our mailing list, they can come to those. And yeah, that's how to stay in touch so far. One day we'll have a website, but so far just socials.
Nice. All right. So Alex Holmstrom-Smith from the Red Cosmos Society, thank you so much for joining us today on the Independent News Hour. That's going to wrap up our show. One more time, if you want to support this station, you can call 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, or go to give number to WBAI.org. Amba, what's our song for exiting today?
Cielito Lindo, speaking of old songs sung for generations, this is sung by a Columbia student mariachi group at their Solidarity Encampment on its second night, April 19th.
Hi, hey there. We want to just leave one more message with you as we head out, which is tune in tomorrow to this station, WBAI, full day Nakba Day coverage. That we got all sorts of shows in the works to really commemorate and learn about this important day in Palestinian history. All day tomorrow on WBAI 99.5 FM. When you support this station, you make that kind of programming possible, and you ain't going to get it anywhere else.
Thank you, Joe.
This is Chaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
The next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting will be on Sunday, May 19th, 2024, at 1 p.m. The call-in number is 619-309-1058. The PIN number is 641711. Everyone is welcome to call in and join the meeting. Again, the call-in number is 619-309-1058. The PIN number is 641711. Hope to see you at the meeting.
Good evening. I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the headlines. President Joe Biden announced Tuesday he's slapping $18 billion in tariffs on Chinese goods. Among the wide variety of products, the tariffs are aimed at medical supplies such as syringes and face masks that became crucial overnight during the COVID pandemic when China was sole producer. Biden said he welcomes competition, but state-subsidized Chinese industry was anything but.
It's not competition, it's cheating. And we've seen damage here in America.
The United States Trade Representative is Ambassador Catherine Tai.
Those are subsidies with an aim to cornering the world market and achieving dominance and creating dependency. The types of support that we're talking about here are defensive in nature.
But President Trump said Biden's plan is too little, too late.
I said, where have you been for 3.5 years? They should have done it a long time ago. But they've also got to do it on other vehicles, and they have to do it on a lot of other products.
because China's eating our lunch right now.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Ukraine on Tuesday to meet with President Volodymyr Zelensky to discuss a $61 billion aid package passed by Congress last month. Zelensky thanked Blinken but asked for more, two Patriot anti-aircraft batteries.
Really, we need today two batteries for Kharkiv, region, because they are, the people are under attack, civilians and warriors, everybody, they are under Russian missiles.
The aid comes as Russian forces are making gains in the war. A Russian offensive has taken swaths of territory along the border between the two nations and captured villages near the front line in the